Welcome to At the Letters opening week edition of the podcast here on Sportsnet's podcast platforms, wherever you find your podcasts. I'm Ben Nicholson-Smith, along with Arden Zwelling. This week's episode produced by Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade as we get ready for opening day. And Arden, you are still in Florida, still in spring training, but we are on the brink of baseball that actually counts. How are you holding up?
I'm holding up well. We made it. Almost all of the Blue Jays pitching staff made it as well. So we're feeling good.
You know, that's actually exactly where I want to start. And I don't to be...
You don't say.
I don't want to be super hyperbolic in this, but when I look at how this unfolded Monday in Bradenton with Kevin Gausman and the Blue Jays, it's actually pretty significant to me. And it sort of changes things for me when I look at this team, because going back a couple of weeks, you look at Kevin Gausman, the uncertainty surrounding his timeline to the major leagues and the fact that he was not really off a mound or certainly not in games until the very, very final day of spring training games, it was hard to know what to expect from him. And in the absence of clear information there, you kind of have to assume that the Jays are going to have to figure it out on the fly and that things are not going according to plan. But he gets out there on a mound against the Pittsburgh Pirates on Monday, and he looked great.
Connor Joe with the pitch. Swing and a miss, struck him out. He threw a fastball right down the middle. And Kevin Gausman is on it today. He's got 7 strikeouts through 3 innings. We'll go to the
like,
fourth.
His stuff was there. He was up to 96, 97 miles an hour. He was throwing his slider and his splitter for strikes, getting swing and miss. This is exactly what you'd want to see from Kevin Gausman if you're the Jays. So as far as spring training developments, like, I actually think final day of spring, Kevin Gausman finally returning to a mound, that to me was one of the bigger developments of the entire spring training.
Well, I remember when we talked about this last week, 2 weeks ago, it's kind of, you know, it all blends together here in Florida, but I gave it like a 10% chance of Gausman being ready for the first turn in the rotation. And you were like, no chance, no way. That's a bit of a role reversal for us, right? Like, usually you leave the door a little bit open and I'm like, no chance. So that kind of tells you like how unlikely it was that Kevin Gausman would be able to get ready for the first turn of the rotation. I think it's important to remember as well, like, he is very much driving this process. Like, Blue Jays are taking a lot of risk by allowing him to do this. And I'm sure that there's plenty of folks in the training department and the medical department who are like, are we sure about this? And Kevin Gausman is very sure of it. And like you said, it's hard to deny the results. The stuff was electric. Like, he was just vaporizing dudes in Bradenton. He was not happy with his splitter, which was like kind of funny to me, because I was like, what's a good splitter to you if that wasn't a good splitter? Like, it was upper 80s and a bunch of them are carrying the zone and getting some really awkward swings. I thought he located some really good fastballs as well into left-handed hitters. Like, that's such an important pitch for him, just to keep those lefties from hanging out over the plate. But Gausman is like, the Blue Jays originally had Gausman lined up to pitch on the minor league side on that day, and he pushed to pitch in a major league game. He wanted to be on the mound against Pirates hitters. He didn't want to do another backfield thing or another minor league, sim environment, anything like that. The Blue Jays definitely wanted to control it a bit more, but I think Gausman proved that he's ready. If he's only 70, 75 pitches in that first turn of the rotation, I mean, you'll take 70, 75 pitches of that version of Kevin Gausman over, 98% of pitchers in Major League Baseball.
For sure. I mean, he's as good as it gets. And you were looking at replacing him with like some combination of Mitch White, maybe Trevor Richards comes in. That is a big difference, right? To go from one of the elite starting pitchers in Major League Baseball to basically guys who are, long relievers, maybe a starting pitcher in Mitch White's case, but huge amounts of uncertainty there. So to get Gausman on a mound built up to 52 pitches is step one. But then beyond that, for his stuff to look as good as it did, the secondary stuff, as you were saying, with the splitter look really good. And I just keep coming back to the fastball velo, because, if he's 95, 96, and again, he was up to 96.9 miles an hour on Monday against the Pirates, then that just gives him that much more room for error. He falls behind against Rowdy Tellez. It's 2-0. It's 2-1. You've got to get back into the count. But if you're throwing 93, major league hitters are going to have a pretty good chance against that pitch. Doesn't mean they're going to hit them all for rockets to the wall or over the wall, but they're going to have a pretty good look at that pitch in a hitter's count. But if you're up to 95, 96 miles an hour, it just gives you that much more room for error. And I saw Gausman use that really effectively. And I think that's a great sign for the Jays as they move forward. So, you know, next time out after throwing 52 pitches, you know, like you say, like maybe it's 70, 75, maybe it's more like 65, 70, you know, whatever it is, he's probably not getting through more than four innings unless he's hyper efficient, but you still do have eight other relievers to go to. And, you know, to get Gausman, maybe it's four the first time, five the second time, and then you're kind of rolling. This is, I mean, even two starts from Kevin Gausman versus Mitch White, I actually think that's a pretty big difference.
Yeah, and you're going to want to be mindful about where you place him in the rotation. I don't, like, you want to be careful that you maybe don't have him go in like a day game after a night game where the night game is started by somebody who you're not going to trust to turn a lineup over two full times. Like, you just have to be careful with how you sort of deploy your innings to begin the year. I think that the Blue Jays' preference would be to have Gausman pitch the fourth game of the season at the Trop and face the Rays and keep him away from the Astros. We'll see. It's going to depend on how he responds to the outing on Monday. We're recording this Tuesday, March 26th in the morning, and we don't have access to the facility down here in Florida. Like, there's no avails. We're not going to be around the club, so can't really like give a report on, you know, how he responded and how he bounced back from it. But if he bounced back well, I think the Blue Jays can just place him, you know, where they ideally and optimally want him to be in the rotation where it makes sense from a workload standpoint for everyone else on the staff. But if he needs an extra day, if he's hanging a little bit and you want to be cautious and bump him to that fifth spot in the rotation, could have him going after Bowden Francis in game number four. And then there's kind of a question of how much you need to use your bullpen over the first three games of the season, and then how much length you need behind Francis, like how deep you're going to let him get into an outing. So there's like a lot of variables at play. But I mean, as long as Kevin Gausman is performing and looking the way that he did in Bradenton, by the way, like his first time this spring pitching with a pitch clock and with umpires watching his delivery for balks and all of the different like variables that you get in a big league environment, and there were no issues with any of that for Gausman. As long as he's looking that way, like this is a big boon to a Blue Jays team that wants to get off to a strong start this year.
In the rotation right now, I mean, it's kind of just your five best starters in the organization, right? Like, I mean, Alek Manoah, this point, you know, he certainly has reached some really good heights, but I think just given what his last 6-7 months have looked like, that puts some question as to what it is that he's able to offer. So you look at the guys who are in there, Bowden Francis, of course, the fifth starter in that group, along with the more established four who were able to start 120 plus games for the Blue Jays last year. I mean, that's a really strong group. So I think if you're the Jays, there's a lot of reason to be optimistic about what that starting rotation can do out of the gate. So then you look in contrast to that in the bullpen. And this is where the Jays are going to start with a couple of their top relievers. Like literally their two best relievers are in all likelihood going to be on the injured list to start the year. Jordan Romano, Eric Swanson, they're both banged up, were not able to finish spring training strong. And so that means, and we haven't seen the official roster announcement, the Jays still working through this, but based on the indications that we're getting from manager John Schneider, certainly appears that Romano and Swanson will be on that injured list. So it kind of leads to two questions. Like, one, how do you get through the highest leverage moments of games against the Rays and the Astros out of the gate? And then two, with those two spots that are open now in the bullpen that would have been filled otherwise by those more established relievers, how do they go about filling it? So I guess let's start with how the Blue Jays actually deal with those leverage innings. How do you see that unfolding?
I think the Chad Green and Jimmy Garcia are the two obvious names. And like Garcia has been just lights out all spring. In his like first outing of spring, he was like 98, 99. I mean, this is a guy who just came into the season ready to go. And that's, you know, I actually chatted with him a little bit about it. And I mean, he worked really hard in this offseason to be in that position to start the year. We saw him like throwing this hard and being this like intense and competitive last year.
There you go. And it's swung on and missed. A fired up Jordan Romano in the dugout after a big, big out by Jimmy Garcia.
We all just sort of assumed, oh, it's because he's getting ready for the WBC. Like, he's getting ramped up a bit earlier. But if you ask Jimmy, he's like, nah, man, that's just what I do. Like, that's just where I want to be at the beginning of camp. You know, he works with Frankie Montas and Dennis Santana, who's in the Yankee system over the offseason. They work in Arizona, and these guys throw like every day off a mound. It's not, you know, full high intensity every day, but they are getting off a mound every day, even if it's just like a lighter, more moderate effort session. So they keep their arms going, and they you know, they come in like ready to go from the jump in spring training. So that's one of the reasons why Jamie's looked as good as he has. And Chad Green is someone who's been toying around with his breaking ball a little bit in this camp, and you know, I wouldn't read too much into his results during these spring outings when he was sort of working on some things and trying to find some stuff. Like, he really took the opportunity of these spring outings to just experiment and tinker with some stuff. Like, I think you'll see a much more Chad Green looking Chad Green to start the year. So those are going to be like your quote unquote replacements, I guess, for Swanson Romano in those like highest of high leverage roles at the back end of the bullpen. And we'll see how long they have to hold that down for. Blue Jays being interestingly coy about Romano and Swanson. I mean, they haven't even, as we sit here on Tuesday morning, they haven't even officially said that those guys are going to open the year on the IL, but we're talking about two pitchers who haven't pitched in like 2 weeks. Like, they haven't been off the mound in 2 weeks. They're only throwing from flat ground right now. I kind of heard yesterday that they might not be off a mound until a week from now. Like, I'm talking the middle of next week. So I don't really understand why the Blue Jays haven't just come out and said like those guys are going to be on the IL. Maybe it's just like a spring training thing. We don't have an active roster. We don't have to tell you that much. This is just how, you know, we're going to play it really close to the vest. But I'm not expecting Romano and Swanson to be part of this bullpen until like at the earliest on that first homestand of the year after the long road trip. So we are talking at the earliest, the middle of April.
Yeah, and teams, they're so often just coy with this kind of information, right? Like, it's, we can read between the lines and really make some educated guesses here. I wonder too, this might be too deeply conspiratorial, but you know, even from a game planning standpoint, you probably want the Rays video people to be game planning for 10 relievers as opposed to 8, right? Like, you probably want to make their life like that much more difficult. End of the day, like, you're not fooling anyone. The Rays can follow this too, and they can really understand that it's highly unlikely. But yeah, teams like to play this out until the very last minute. So yeah,
some poor analyst making like $60K a year has to work through his weekend and like miss dinner with his wife.
Oh, I believe it. I baseball's schedule is unrelenting. It waits for no one. Certainly not for the video analysts who are out there doing all kinds of work at all hours of the day. So, you know, for the Blue Jays, this means that you do have, in all likelihood, a couple spots at the back of their bullpen. And let's work off that assumption here. So to me, when I look at this, like, we can sit here and talk all day about Zach Pop and Nate Pearson. And okay, like, maybe one of those guys will be on the roster. Maybe a Brendan Little will be on the roster. There's opportunity there. But to me, I just look at Yuriel Rodriguez in this as the most interesting arm. And to be honest with you, the more I've thought about it, Arden, the more I actually think, like, put him in there. You're trying to win games at the major league level. It's really tough to do. He's a major league arm. I understand there's a counter argument to be made here developmentally, and there is potentially a downside to having him in the major leagues where he cannot get as many innings as regularly after a season in which he did not pitch professionally. But to me, when I look at the pros and cons, and when I look at a team that might miss or make the playoffs by a single game in 2024, if it's me, I'd rather do that with Yuriel Rodriguez as opposed to Zach Pop.
So let's build this thing out, right? We've got Garcia and Green at the very back end. We've got the lefties in Mesa and Cabrera. That's four. You've got Trevor Richards, Mitch White. That's six. I'd say those guys are all locks. I think that like Nate Pearson is like 90% lock. It's not a sure thing, but I think that we should put him into like the lock category just for the sake of this discussion. So that sure. leaves one final spot. Because that's seven right there. So the options for that spot, as you said, Ariel Rodriguez among those options, Zach Pop as well. I don't think Brendan Little's an option at this time. Like, he's somebody who the Blue Jays are high on, but like, he just wasn't consistent enough with his command this spring. He's already been optioned to AAA, which tells you something. And the Blue Jays have the two lefties in Mesa and Cabrera, and then Trevor Richards, who can kind of function as a lefty as well with that changeup. So I don't think they need another lefty. So I'm going to like put Little aside. And then I guess Wes Parsons is in that conversation as well. So really it is just like Rodriguez, Pop, and Parsons. I don't think the Blue Jays are in a position right now to add anyone to their 40.
Right. Because they're already going to have to remove someone.
Exactly.
When they make room to break camp.
It really is Rodriguez, Pop, or Parsons. I think we could put Parsons aside because that's like honestly kind of important starting pitching depth for you at this point. Like, that's somebody who, if you had an injury in your rotation in the first turn of the rotation this season, Parsons is probably the guy who you're calling upon. He's on the roster. Maybe you prefer Espino, but Espino's not on the roster. So I would rather keep Parsons pitching regularly just with Buffalo, just every 5 days, so that he's on hand as your number six. So now we're down to Yariel Rodriguez and Zach Pop. And I think you could go either way, because I think the Blue Jays are they're okay lengthwise with like Mitch White and Trevor Richards. Like, those guys can both go three innings, and then Pearson, Green, Cabrera, those guys can all go two innings or one plus at least. So I think you're okay lengthwise. It doesn't have to be Rodriguez. You could take Pop. I think Rodriguez is probably the better pitcher at this time, probably the more useful guy at this time. But as you alluded to, like, you are balancing what's best for your team short term with what's best for Yariel Rodriguez long term. And like, in a perfect world, you would have a set schedule for Rodriguez on how he's going to build up this year, because you're working with limited innings. Remember, coming off of 23 when he didn't pitch competitively after the WBC. So it's like important to get him onto somewhat of a structured schedule where he is pitching regularly, rebuilding that innings base, and just putting himself in a position to continue building throughout his deal, which, you know, runs for seasons beyond this one. The thing is, like, you can only control the environment and the circumstances so much at the big league level, right? Like, you can only structure that so much. You can do that much easier at AAA. So it's kind of like, do you want to prioritize the development and kind of getting him working regularly and working on a lot of the delivery refinements that he's going to be working on as the Blue Jays try to get some of that hesitation out of there and get the arm slot and release point a lot more consistent? Or do you bring him to the big leagues to be potentially pitching medium leverage innings for you while you are down a couple of your higher leverage relievers, because he's like your better option to help you win games right now at the big league level? Like, that's kind of the push-pull of this. And I would imagine that there is like a lot of debate about which way is best to go within the Blue Jays organization.
Yeah, I think there are compelling arguments, and I definitely would acknowledge, like, hey, there is a case to be made that you need to just make sure that this guy who is a long-term part of your organization gets some sort of sea legs under him before you put him into the major leagues. Like, I understand that's a viable argument, but end of the day, I just think that there are times in a team's arc where you're going to be conservative. You're going to take every step and just build up super, super gradually. But I'm not sure that 2024 is one of those times for the Jays. And I'm not saying you do this with Ricky Tiedemann and you're like, yeah, we're taking Tiedemann over Yenesis Cabrera. No, like, that's a guy where he's 21 years old. Of course, you need to give him some more professional experience and some chance to actually have these reps as a professional. But Yariel Rodriguez does have professional experience. It didn't come last year, but he has pitched at a high level before. And he's not a kid. He's 27 years old. And he's making $32 million. So it's not even like, oh, what if we blow out his arm? Obviously, you don't want that to happen. But he's here to help the major league team win. And I think that you look at him versus Wes Parsons, who, you know, again, I agree with you that Wes Parsons actually makes more sense stretched out at AAA and continuing to build up and continuing to provide insurance. But when I look at Zach Pop, the results were not good last year in the majors. They were not good in AAA. You look at his expected stats on his sinker. There's an ex-WOBA of 396. That's his best pitch, and hitters were destroying it last year. So, you know, unless the Blue Jays have reason to believe that there is some significant change compared to last year, I don't look at Zach Pop as someone who is an above average major league pitcher. And I do look at Yuriel Rodriguez that way. I think that he can do that, has those tools and those pitches to be able to get hitters out at the highest level. And so to me, when I'm thinking about how to win games in 2024, it's pretty clear which one of those pitchers I would choose.
Yeah, and Rodriguez has demonstrated some pretty compelling stuff this spring. I think you'd probably like him to be on the plate a bit more than he has been. But look, his like fastball is 94, 95. At least that's where he's been sitting. And he'll get up to 97 when he needs to. He's got all those varying arm slots, which, you know, I'm sure that, you know, pitching developers and pitching coaches probably don't love, but it definitely makes things uncomfortable for a hitter. It makes it hard to kind of think along with him and expect what's coming. And he's got some like really high spin breaking stuff that breaks really sharply. He also has the benefit of surprise, where major league hitters are not going to be like familiar with him, so they're going to take some time to kind of figure him out. You know, all the video on him is going to be from NPB or WBC. Like, you're not going to have an amazing scouting report on him, an amazing idea of his game plan coming into it. So that could be a benefit for the Blue Jays out of their bullpen. And then obviously, you know, the length that he can provide would help if, you know, if Francis and Kikuchi are going to be just like, you know, two trips and through guys, and Kevin Gausman only has 70, 75 pitches, and whoever he's facing, whether it's the Rays or the Astros, best believe they're going to know that, and that is going to play into their approach against Kevin Gausman, and they're going to do everything they can to elevate that pitch count as early in the game as possible. So, like, ultimately, the question you have to answer is just whether you can get Rodriguez regular, like, consistent, semi-predictable work in the majors as much as you can within the constraints of the big league season, or like if his usage would just be too sporadic based on game circumstances and needing to win games at the big league level. And if that would just like derail his season and put him in a hole that he could spend the rest of the year trying to climb out from at AAA. And if maybe he would just be better served with a more structured schedule in Buffalo to start the year.
Here's what I would do. I would say to Yuriel Rodriguez, look, we have an opportunity right now. We need you right now in the major leagues. And then if he ends up excelling, you keep him in the major leagues, you roll with it, great, everyone's happy. If he ends up struggling, you set it up at the beginning where it's like, we have this need for you now. We still want to make sure we get you on a proper routine. So, you know, we may end up sending you to Buffalo, but for now, we want you to start in the majors and we really believe in you, et cetera, et cetera. Then I would use him in low leverage. Like, this is not a guy you're bringing in with a 3-1 lead in the sixth inning, you know, after Gausman gives you five. It's not how he's going to start his professional career. So you start him in low leverage. You're down 6-1 against the Astros. Here he comes. He pitches two, maybe three innings, and you see how it goes. And you do have that option. You can always adjust course. But to me, and it sounds like you're kind of aligned with me here, correct me if I'm wrong on that, but to me, I would start him in that capacity and just let the results determine the next steps.
Yeah, you hope that that opportunity, that low leverage opportunity, presents itself for you. The games may have something else to say, right? Like, at the big league level, you're just at the mercy of game flow. In AAA, you can control those things a lot more reliably. So I see it both ways. I think there's compelling arguments on either side. The one thing I will say is, like, we are seeing the Blue Jays take some risks early in the year, and kind of they're really funneling like talent to their big league roster, whether or not it's like the best long-term decision to make. Like, Kevin Gausman's a primary example of that. Like, in a perfect, ideal, optimal world, I don't know that you'd have Kevin Gausman throwing his second game of the season. He made one big league appearance in spring training. His second game of the season, not fully stretched out, coming like in a start in the big leagues in the first week of the season. Like, that's not optimal. That's not ideal. But the Blue Jays are taking that risk because They want to get off to a good start and they want to win games. You look at their bench, it would have been pretty easy to just carry Nathan Lucas for the beginning of the year in that 13th roster spot or that 13th position player spot. And the Blue Jays are saying, no, we're going to take Daniel Vogel back, who we may have to pay like $2 million for the right to carry his bat out of the gates because we want somebody who could put one in the seats off our bench. Like, this is a guy who may not see that many plate appearances in the first week of the season, but we're gonna carry Vogel back. We're going to select him to our roster. We're going to open up a 40-man spot because we are prioritizing winning out of the gates and being competitive out of the gates. So the fact that the Blue Jays have done that in a couple other areas of their roster tells me that they would be open to carrying Rodriguez as well.
Yeah, I mean, and let's get to the bench now. But I guess, like, first to that theme, broadly speaking, like, this is not a Blue Jays team that's going to win the East by six games, and it's not a team that's going to miss the playoffs by six games. So whatever happens, whatever you think is going to happen in this season, it's going to be pretty tense, I would think. I mean, that's a pretty reasonable guess when you look at the caliber of this team. So every single marginal win then is really significant. And so that brings us to the bench, where, as you said, Vogelbach will be on this team. Espinal traded. He's in Cincinnati. Ernie Clement on the team. David Schneider on the bench. Brian Servin, as predicted on ATL, will be that second catcher for now. He'll need a 40-man spot too. That's open for now. A second 40-man spot will have to be cleared. Maybe time to say goodbye to a Hagen Danner or to a Yosfer Zulueta or maybe even to a Brendan Little. We will see what they do on that front. But this bench has taken shape, and I agree with you that it's really interesting to see that Daniel Vogelbach is part of this team. And I think that, look, he might not play that much. He's the 26th or 25th player on this roster. But I really think that from the day that they signed him, I thought that was a deal that made sense. I like that deal. He might not be there for that long, right? Joey Votto not close to returning as we record this, but within a few weeks, that could change. I do think Votto will get the chance to play himself off this team if and when he's healthy. And that could mean that Vogelbach is off the roster within a few weeks. But in the meantime, he is a major league bat who can really help you against quality right-handed pitching. So I actually like this call, and it does allow them to preserve depth in the organization because you still have Nathan Lucas available.
So let me make a quick comment about Nathan Lucas and the 40-man spot. I don't think the Blue Jays will do this. And like the way that they'll likely open that 40-man spot, as you said, like a Danner, a Zulueta, I mean, one of those depth relievers. Maybe you think about a Leo Jimenez, but I think they would probably go with one of the relievers being, you know, moved off the roster to open that spot. But something I would love to see the Blue Jays do is move Nathan Lucas to a better situation. Find him a better situation in MLB, because this is a big leaguer. And like I said, they're not going to do it because, like, they, I'm sure, love having the depth of a Nathan Lucas optionable within their system. Are really good, like, outfielder, base runner, or really competent hitter. A big league player, like a guy who came into camp and, like, did not only meet the Blue Jays expectations, but, like, exceeded them at the plate, defensively, base running, character, teammate, all of that, like, checked all of the boxes, and is just such a poor fit for the Blue Jays current roster construction, because Varsho and Kiermaier are both left-handed hitters, and then your quote-unquote fourth outfielder, at least one of them, and Kevin Biggio is also a lefty, so there just isn't room to carry Lucas on this roster. But this is a big league player, and he's 29, and I just hate seeing him have to have the career that he's having right now. Like, you look at the Rockies just traded for Jake Cave from the Phillies for cash. Is Jake Cave that much better than Nathan Lucas? Honestly, I think that, like, Nathan Lucas could have been the fit there. Man, the Cardinals, they got to need an outfielder right now. Nootbaar's on the IL, Edmonds hurt. Dylan Carlson and Jordan Walker just, like, ran into each other in the outfield on Monday. I don't know what the fallout from that is, but it looked really nasty. Like, there are opportunities elsewhere where Nathan Lucas could be an everyday big leaguer, and I would love to see that happen. I'd love to see the Blue Jays get him to that situation, but I just don't think that they will. Do you have a comment on that before I move the vocal back?
Yeah, just real quick. I mean, you could also make it mutually beneficial, right? Like, if you're the Blue Jays, we're talking about how they have this question at the back of their bullpen. Like, you could do a need for need trade where, let's say it's the Cardinals. That's a good example. If they have an optionable reliever then who's on their 40 man, then you could do a trade where the Jays get the reliever back. That fills out your bullpen, gives you a legitimate competitive major league arm to go along with Pearson in those 7-8 spots in the bullpen. Now you have Yuriel Rodriguez stretching out at AAA. You're keeping his development in mind. You're not rushing him. But again, it comes down to if you have a good alternative for the major league bullpen. So if there was a trade chip that was appealing enough, I could envision a need for need situation where Lucas goes somewhere else and does get that opportunity that you're talking about.
Yeah, like a Matthew Liberatore, who is kind of, I'm just quickly looking at the bat, you know, the edge of their bullpen. Maybe. Yeah,
exactly. Like, I mean, that could be a fair trade.
Right? Like, that could make sense. That's a guy, that's not somebody who, you know, is going to be pitching a ton of leverage in their bullpen. That's somebody who, you know, has shown some interesting things as a pitcher, had a ton of prospects shine at one time. I think he's definitely past that now. Still has options. Maybe somebody who the Blue Jays want to work with, right? So, yeah, sign me up for, like, getting Lucas to a better situation, because I just feel bad for him, just to be completely candid.
Yeah.
But the Vogelback of it all is like, it's very interesting, because like, this is the position player roster spot that the Blue Jays really don't have a use for. Like, they'd much rather have a pitcher, but they can only take 13 pitchers. So if they had their druthers, they would only take 12 position players. But because they've got this 13th position player spot, they've like tried these very specific like tools within that spot over the last couple of years, like Jackie Bradley Jr. as the like premium defender, Bradley Zimmer is the speed demon. And it seems like this year, the thing that they're going to use that like the very narrow skill set they're going to use that roster spot on is left-handed patience and pop off the bench, whether that's Vogelback or Votto. Like, clearly this is a role that they wanted to have on their bench. This is like a skill set they wanted to have on their bench, clearly, because you've seen that in the acquisitions that they've made and the way that they forced Vogelback onto this roster, even while they have Votto perhaps ready to be that guy by May. We'll see how long it takes him to get over this ankle issue. So it's gonna be very interesting just to see how this plays out, how Vogelback performs, what his opportunities look like, you know, how they get him into the starting lineup, because he's only going to DH. He's not going to play first base. As someone told, you know, said to me the other day, like, we'd put DeMarlo Hale at first base before we'd put Daniel Vogelback there. So like he's going to have to be a DH. So that means Justin Turner's going to have to be in the field, or Turner's going to have to be on the bench. Like, we'll see how the Blue Jays construct that. We'll see what the pinch hit opportunities look like for him. There's also Vogelback's salary at play here, which is going to be $2 million at the big league level whenever his contract is selected ahead of opening day. And the only way like the Blue Jays would have around paying him that full $2 million is if he signed a 45-day advance consent form, which like, we could really get into the nitty-gritty of those roster rules, but like, the high level is that it would give the Blue Jays like a 45-day window in which they could outright him off the roster, revert the deal back to a minor league deal, and only pay him the prorated amount of those $2 million. So if he was in the big leagues for, say, the month of April, and then they outrighted him, they would owe him 1/6 of the $2 million, so $333,000. And then at that point, if Joey Votto was ready and productive and they felt he was a better option, you bring up Joey Votto on his $2 million salary, and, you know, just over the course of the season, you only end up spending the $2 million on that spot. I don't know that Vogelback has signed that form. It is something that players in his position are often asked to sign by teams, because players in that position on minor league deals often don't have a ton of leverage and don't have other options, particularly this winter when you look at, you know, Brandon Belt still being a free agent and like Luke Voit just became a free agent. Like, there's a lot of other guys in that, you know, similar class that other teams would have options for. So I could imagine Vogelback being asked to sign that and the Blue Jays saying, hey, like, if you don't sign this, like, you're not going to be a big leaguer with us, and we'll carry Spencer Horwitz because we need the flexibility. But I don't know that they have asked him to sign that or not. If they haven't, and if he hasn't signed it, and if Vogelback ends up off the roster after the first month of the year and Votto comes up, then the Blue Jays have spent $4 million on this very narrow role and utility in that roster spot. And it's just another example of them like really like funneling as much talent and as much just utility, or it's another example of them really funneling as much talent as possible towards the roster early in the season, and really pushing their chips in to win as many games as possible out of the gate.
Right. And it's ultimately, this is a really big market team. $4 million, even if it ends up being that, for a DH spot that, you know, maybe by May they're both off the roster. Maybe by June they're both off. Who knows, right? How this could all unfold. And it might not be the most efficient way they spend money this year. But end of the day, it's $4 million on a part-time player. We're not talking about $180 on Blake Snell. We're not talking about $210 for Cody Bellinger. For a big market team, these are expenses that you have to take on. You're trying to win this year. It costs money. This is part of what it costs. So I think it makes sense to proceed with the best roster you can, even if that means accepting some inefficiencies along the way. And even if it means, like, if we get to a point, let's say, you know, Joey Votto gets some of those at-bats first, an extended spring, then potentially heads to Buffalo and builds up. And if he's looking really good, and he is a better option to Daniel Vogelbach, well, then you can DFA Vogelbach and you can potentially trade him. Or, as you say, maybe there's the advanced consent option. He's able to, you know, go to the minor leagues and stay in the organization that way even better. But ultimately, you have to try to get the most production possible. And I don't see a situation where both Votto and Vogelbach are on the team with a Vlad and a Justin Turner, because at that point, you're probably looking at too many players who do too much of the same thing. But I don't think that you necessarily run into that. And maybe by the time Votto's healthy, Justin Turner's dealing with something, or maybe Vladdy is. You just don't know. So I don't think it's actually a bad situation. I think the way they've played it out so far makes sense. And you just kind of keep letting it play out, because it's actually pretty rare that you get to a point in the season where you truly have too many viable options for the major league roster.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it would be tenable to have both Vogelbach and Votto on this roster in a world where Turner and Vlad are healthy and playing regularly. Yeah. Like, on, you know, on the salary side, like, yes, like, for a big market team, it's, you know, relative to, you know, their overall payroll, yes, it's a very small slice, but we are talking about a team that is well into the luxury tax at this point, and maybe, you know, depending on how you want to calculate the CBT, like, $6 to $7 million, maybe even less, maybe even only five from that second luxury tax threshold. So, you know, already running like a franchise record payroll, like, this could limit what the Blue Jays can do at the trade deadline, or even in season before the trade deadline. Although every year we do that thing where we're like, the Blue Jays should go out and get somebody in May or in June. And that's just not the way the teams operate. And it's just not what happens any year. Like, all the activity comes towards the deadline. So it really is going to be at that juncture when they can kind of make decisions about and look to take on salary and try to augment their roster to win games over the final 2 months and get into the postseason and be as competitive as possible. So, like, it's interesting, you know, like, last year they took Nathan Lucas out of camp. Last year, I think they prioritized, you know, depth of roster and long term and a lot of these other things. It does feel like with some of the decisions they're making right now, they're prioritizing, how do we win as many possible games in April? It's interesting to see them behaving this way.
You know, trying to win as many games as you can in April seems like a good idea. I think it makes sense. And we've gone granular enough, so let's step aside. And when we come back, we'll go a little bit bigger picture on this team and what's ahead for them in 2024. Coming up next on At the Letters. Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Welcome back to At the Letters for Tuesday, March 26th, 2024, opening week edition of the podcast. And we went over the latest news and developments in the first half, but now it's time to go a little bit bigger picture and weigh in on this team as they begin really a pivotal season. And I guess before we even get into some of the roster stuff, Arden, like, let's just hear your thoughts on where this team sits as far as the arc of this franchise. Everything on, off the field, fan expectations, Ross Atkins, the GM, you know, with a lot of pressure, right? John Schneider facing a lot of pressure. The stadium renovation has occurred. You know, before we get too far into the weeds here, let's hear your big picture thoughts on what's at stake here.
That is a tremendous amount of variables to sum up into 60 seconds here. I will say it's a Yeah, just touch on, you know, the entire management, the entire front office, the stadium, the operations, the team itself, and fan expectations. Yeah, just a couple things. I think it is an important year for the Toronto Blue Jays. It is potentially a pivot year for the Toronto Blue Jays. And like so much of it just comes down to like what's coming off the books in the next couple of years. Like you've got essentially like almost the entire team that could be hitting free agency after 25 or 26, and a bunch of guys who are going to be coming off after like 24. Like if you're going to, you know, run it back again, like say the Blue Jays get to a divisional series and bow out in five games and you're like, we're running it back again last year, Bo and Vlad in 2025. Well, you're going to need to replace Kikuchi and replace a Turner and a Kiermaier and a Garcia and a Danny Jansen. Like there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of moving pieces here for the Blue Jays over the next couple of years. And the biggest thing that they have lacked over the last 12 months, arguably 24, is just upward pressure on their roster from within the organization. Just not a good enough job, in my opinion, of drafting and developing and like supplementing the big league roster with young, controllable talent from within. Like that's the biggest thing this year for me, for the Blue Jays, is they need to produce two or three players who are capable of being above average big league players from within. Like 2 to 3 win players need to be coming out of this system more frequently than they have been over the last couple of years. Otherwise, like there are likely some pretty lean years ahead for the Blue Jays.
Yeah, this is a huge one. There's no question about that. I think that it's all about results. It's all about what happens at the major league level. You know, of course, I guess that's slightly, you know, an over the top statement because you do also want to see strides taken in the minor leagues. But end of the day, this is a season where it's about what happens with the major league team and specifically what happens with the major league team in the playoffs. And I understand, like, you can look at what's happened since 2016 with this team in the playoffs, and they're winless, obviously, swept in 2020, 2022, and 2023. And you can look at that, and smart baseball people can look at that and say, it's random. You know, the playoffs in baseball are random. And that's not just people with the Blue Jays who will bring that up when you're talking about postseason baseball. And I understand that. I mean, I love baseball stats and I love looking at the game through that analytical lens, but I think it misses something. And I think that you can't just shrug your shoulders and say, well, I guess, you know, it's just random. The roll of the dice just didn't go the Blue Jays' way. Nothing they can do. I actually think you got to improve your chances as much as you possibly can by building a team that A, wins the division, which I don't think the Blue Jays have a division winning team on them this year. And then B, if you are going to be in the wild card, better to go in as a 570 win percentage team than a 540 win percentage team. And better to go in with a team that's healthy and rested. Better to go in with a team that, if you are going to be in that situation, has relievers who are capable of absolutely dominating a game late when you're in those high leverage situations and you're not handing the ball over to Anthony Bass with the season on the line as they did in 2022. So I think there are measures you can take, even accepting and understanding that baseball is unpredictable and the baseball playoffs are never going to be representative of a team's true talent. I think you can still put your hand on the scale a little bit and help yourself out a little bit. And the Jays are obviously trying to do that, but we'll see really how far that can take them. And I do think it's all about what happens in October this year.
Yeah, you know, like how I'm wired. Like I see the last four seasons of Blue Jays baseball as like the most successful run of just sustained winning baseball that this team's had since the early 90s. Like you look at four straight winning seasons, you look at 89 wins last year, 92 the win the year before that, 91 the year before that. Like I haven't gone and done this, but if you went and took every team across MLB and accumulated their records over the last 3 to 4 seasons, like their regular season records, I promise you the Blue Jays are near the top. So that to me is much more impressive than winning a 2-game wild card series. Like I fall much more on the side of the postseason is just like a fun tournament where anything can happen. It's just March Madness after the season. But I understand that I am definitely isolated in that view and in that take. But I think it also does, at least like if you look at it objectively, reveal like how thin the margins are for how people feel about like where a team is at. Like last year, if the Blue Jays beat the Twins in that wild card series, and like there, you know, it's not like there were a ton of, it's not like the Blue Jays like got blown out by the Twins last year in that series, right? Like what was the cumulative score in the series? Like 5-1, you know, there wasn't a ton in it. It was 3-1 in game one and 2-0 in game two. So, I mean, that's a couple of 2-run homers from being very, very different. So say the Blue Jays win that series and they go to the DS and they have the same fate that the Twins had against the Astros and they lose in four games. I wonder how differently people would have felt over the course of the offseason and even entering this year if Blue Jays had just had that small modicum of postseason success last year. If they had just won two postseason games, just two games, then I bet you that the narratives and the tenor and the commentary, the discourse would have felt a lot different with only two more wins.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And there's something that sort of doesn't quite add up logically when you look at it that way, because the whole response is so heightened and, you know, arguably exaggerated because of what happens in those two games. At the same time, we all knew that those two games were going to happen. We all knew that they were going to count. And it those games did expose some of the Blue Jays' flaws, like Vlad Jr. getting picked off second base. Okay, maybe it's just a moment in time. Maybe someone wants to call that random. But I would say it was emblematic of a lack of focus and attention to detail. Or I want to dial that back. I'll say it was emblematic of a lack of skill on the bases, a lack of good judgment on the bases that we saw all season long when the Blue Jays objectively were one of the worst base running teams in baseball. So, you know, that for that to come up in the playoffs, like, not a big surprise to me. I think that when you're looking at four-year windows, I agree. The Blue Jays have been, without a doubt, one of the best regular season teams in baseball over a four-year period. But you don't get a trophy for that. We all know that's not the goal. And I do think that if you're talking about four-year windows for this team since the early 90s, the best four-year window, in my opinion, has to include 15 and 16, where A, they won a division title in that period of time, and then B, they also made it to the ALCS 2 years in a row. So I wouldn't say this has been more successful than that, even if they have won more regular season games.
We're like so off track right now. But if you're putting like, if you're doing a 4 year window with 15 and 16 in there, then you're including a like a losing season in some way.
Sure.
If you're talking a four year window. So
maybe two losing seasons.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And it's hard for me to say that's more impressive than like the winning the Blue Jays have shown in the regular season over the last 4 years. I've made this argument so many times before. I'm sure people are sick of it. But like to me, like the Dodgers over the last 10 years, even though they've won only once, they've won only one World Series. To me, they've been a dynasty. To me, they've been the best team in baseball. They've been absolutely just phenomenal. It's so, so, so much more impressive to me what the Dodgers have done over the last 10 years in terms of like their success and their play in the regular season, the amount of games that they've won over the course of these 6 month marathons that these teams win, rather than the occasional club that, you know, has a pretty good sprint in October.
Right. And I mean, that includes three World Series appearances for the Dodgers. I'm not even going to try to count the number of NLCS appearances. Totally agree. They've been MLB's model franchise. You know, if the Jays get to the point that they're losing World Series every couple of years, like that would actually be great. That would be many steps ahead of where they are right now. We'll see where it leads. I mean, there is a big gap, and the Jays, you know, have hopes of being one of the elite teams in Major League Baseball. To me, being a wild card team a couple years in a row, doesn't get them there. They need to do much more, and it has to happen in the playoffs. Even if they're a little bit random, you have to win in the playoffs to be considered really one of those top teams. The Jays are not there yet. The Jays do a lot of things well. They have had a lot of success in the regular season. They have a lot of good players, and they might do some really good things this year, but they have not reached those heights yet.
Sure. Let's get off this before I dig my hole with people any further. How do you feel about the Blue okay. Jays rotation depth?
Well, yeah, let's go there. So rotation depth, I said this to Blake the other day. We were talking about this. And my first instinct if I'm being really honest, is to say that the Blue Jays have bad rotation depth. Okay. Like that's like where my mind goes.
That but is, then I do that's check interesting. Myself. What a take. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to defend this one.
Well, I'm just trying to be transparent here, right? Like that's honestly where my mind goes. And then I need to check myself as we do sometimes this time of year, or really any time. And I look at some of the other rotations for contending teams around Major League Baseball. And let's take the Texas Rangers. All right, they have Dane Dunning and Cody Bradford rounding out their rotation. And everyone would say the Texas Rangers are a good team. And those are the guys who are in their rotation. The Orioles have Tyler Wells and Cole Irvin in their rotation. The New York Yankees have Clark Schmidt and Luis Hill in the rotation, to say nothing of their 6 and their 7 and their 8. So then at that point, when I look at the Blue Jays rotation, and okay, let's say it's Mitch White, let's say it's Ricky Tiedemann in a month's time, you know, if all goes well, we'll see how that unfolds. It's Wes Parsons, maybe it's Paolo Espino. And none of those options are the ideal. But I actually think I'm going to revise my initial gut impulse here, and I don't want to say that their rotation is suspect or bad. I don't believe that it is. I actually think their rotation depth is fine, and you're not thrilled with it, but rarely are you ever thrilled with your number 6 through 8 starters. And I think their rotation depth is perfectly viable.
Yeah, that I 100% agree with that. Like I think that, you know, we get so like myopic on one team that you kind of forget like the greater perspective of the fact that no team in baseball is ecstatic about their number 6, number 7 starter. Like no team has enough pitching. No team is like, oh my God, our organizational pitching depth is just like so deep. What are we going to do with all these capable big leaguers? Like it just doesn't exist. Still waiting for, you know, like a Fangraphs or a Savant or someone to come up with like a depth metric that can like measure. I don't know if you would use like projection systems or like how you would kind of figure this out, but that would kind of quantify like organizational depth into one tidy number. I know that Ben Clemens did a lot of writing about that at Fangraphs recently. It's a pretty hard thing to do, to just like assess depth team by team across baseball. But just from a Blue Jays perspective, I just feel like their starting pitching depth this year is a lot stronger than it was last year, when coming out of the gates, it was like Zach Thompson and Drew Hutchison were the guys. And then it only took about, you know, a month of AAA results to realize those were not the guys. And those were not pitchers that the Blue Jays were going to trust, as evidenced by the fact that when Alek Manoah like pitched his way out of the big leagues, and by the way, Alek Manoah was given a ton of rope last year because the Blue Jays did not have a better option. But once it was like, all right, like Alek Manoah cannot start another game for us at the big league level, the choice the Blue Jays made was to go with a 4-man rotation for like a month instead of having a fifth guy in there, because they didn't have a fifth guy. They didn't have someone who they trusted. So this year, at least you have like a Wes Parsons who the Blue Jays trust. I know he had a tough Blue Jays debut last year, but just like look at the overall body of work and the way he's throwing the ball, I think that there is like a capable back end starter in there. We've talked about Yariel Rodriguez. Paolo Espino, you know what you're going to get. That is somebody who will be reliable for you if you need him to make some starts. And then Ricky Tiedemann, who is like going to be on this team at some point this year, provided he stays healthy. Like he could have a Manoah arc from 2021. Remember when Manoah went to AAA and was just like vaporizing dudes for like 4 outings and forced his way to the majors? Ricky Tiedemann could do something similar and be up here in like mid-May. And then you've also got like a Chad Dallas and a CJ Van Eyck and an Adam Macko who are like a little bit further removed, but could push their way closer to the big league roster this year. So I just think that like relative to where it was last year, the Blue Jays have much better starting pitching depth.
Agreed. They seem to be honestly in a pretty good spot in that respect. And this is where Gausman coming back just bumps everyone else down a spot. That is huge. That's why that Monday outing for me was such a big development. But, you know, we've gotten this far in the podcast without really talking about the offense. So let's take stock of where the Blue Jays are at offensively. Clearly a huge part of any team's game. It's literally half the game is scoring runs. So that is massively important for a team that really underwhelmed in that department last year and underperformed in some cases. So big picture, as you look at this offense, what is your level of confidence that this group can keep the Blue Jays really competitive on a nightly basis?
I expect it to be better if they stay healthy. Like, I expect Dalton Varsho to be better than he was last year offensively. I expect Vladimir Guerrero Jr. to be better. I expect George Springer to be better. I expect Bo Bichette to take another step and honestly, like, maybe mess around and win a batting title and maybe be like a top five MVP finalist.
Year before that, Bichette with a high drive to left field, racing back. Gonzalez on the track, looking up. It's out of here. Two-run home run, Bo Bichette.
I wouldn't be surprised if all those things happened, but they're going to have to stay healthy and they're going to have to carry over like some of the really promising approach stuff that they showed this spring. Like, the spring training results for this lineup were incredible. Like, there were a ton of guys who were raking. I don't put a lot of stock into spring training results. I do put a lot of stock into process, though, into how you're getting to those results. And you look at the chase rates team-wide. I mean, this was a team that really bought into like the what Don Mattingly has been preaching about zoning up and getting to your pitch in your part of the zone that you can drive, and to not making outs on pitchers' pitches, and to be, you know, working more competitive plate appearances, seeing more pitches, you know, kind of like the Justin Turner of it all. You saw that up and down the lineup. Guys like Dalton Varsho and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. were just chasing far less. Guys like Alejandro Kirk and George Springer were doing better damage on the pitches they can do damage against, making, you know, Ernie Clement's quality of contact and you know, extra base hit numbers looked a lot better. Even Isaiah Kiner-Falefa like did a really good job of getting to his pitch to drive in spring. That's why he had really good spring numbers. It's no guarantee it's going to carry over into the regular season, but like it's hard not to be encouraged by like the process and the approach that the Blue Jays showed up and down the lineup this spring.
Yeah, and I think too, as long as we're talking about spring and what we can take away in a meaningful way, to me, we say this every spring, but it's, can you get through it mostly healthy? And Danny Jansen, unfortunately for him and for the Blue Jays, will start on the injured list. Otherwise, though, I mean, Justin Turner made it through. Kevin Kiermaier made it through. George Springer did. So you're talking about three guys in their mid to late 30s who made it through and seem to be in a good spot physically to start the season. So that is not something that you necessarily take for granted on a veteran team. And I think that with those guys healthy and ready to produce, bounce backs, I think, in store for Varsho and Vlad, among others, there are the makings of a really good offense here. And we've talked about this before. I'm not predicting like a top three offense in baseball, but I do think they can be in the top third of teams really without reaching too far. And they're going to have to be. I mean, the pitching in some ways will take steps back this season. We talked about the vulnerability in the bullpen off the top. So they are going to have to win some 8-6 ball games. And I think that this group is capable of that.
Yeah, this is going to just way oversimplify something that is a lot more complicated than I am expressing it. But I think the key for this offense all year is just going to be consistency in swing decisions. And it's just going to be swinging at strikes and not swinging at balls. And the strikes that you were swinging at are the pitches on the areas of the plate where your swing does damage. And the pitches from the like specific pitcher that night who you have game planned for and prepared for, the pitch that pitcher throws that you want to be executing your swing against. I think if the Blue Jays can be consistent with that over 6 months, I think the offense can do well. The true test is, it's one thing to do it in March like the Blue Jays have. It's another to continue doing it through May and June and July, like when the marathon gets hard, when you get into the middle of it and you're tired and you're carrying like four minor injuries and it hurts to get out of the bed in the morning and you've been, you know, traveling a ton and you're mentally worn out and you're so sick of like Arden asking you questions every day and it's like a grind to come to the ballpark and it's day game after a night game and it's like 35 degrees in Atlanta or wherever you're at and you got to drag your ass out there to try to compete. Like, can you have the consistency in approach and swing decisions at that time where it gets tough? Like, can you maintain this over the course of a season? Because that's what the best players in this sport do. They are remarkably consistent and routine oriented and disciplined. That's how you put up like really strong 6 month seasons. So I think that's really going to be the test for the Blue Jays.
And it would be a lot easier to accomplish that goal and to pass that test if they have some support. And we've talked before a couple weeks ago on ATL about how, hey, you know, it doesn't necessarily seem like there's someone who's just like bursting through in the upper minors on the position player front, and that, you know, Addison Barger and Orelvis Martinez and Alan Roden, yeah, like they're really interesting prospects. They're legitimately promising players, but they're not right there on the cusp. So as the Blue Jays look to get through the grind of the season and 162 games in 185 days, they would really be in a much better position if one or two of those guys can step up in a meaningful way. And I'll even include Davis Schneider in that mix, and maybe Ernie Clement in that mix, where there will be opportunity for some of these less proven players, some of these younger players. And if Ernie Clement can build on what he did in spring, and maybe it's over 250 at-bats and he's able to post a 790 OPS, like how big would that be for this ball club? And I think there's always opportunity for guys like that, even on a team where you do have a lot of established players. And so if they can get one or two of those younger players to emerge as viable contributors, that can make the difference between a season where you win 86 and you're on the outside looking in, and a season where you win 88 and you're wild card number two.
Yeah, if Orelvis Martinez can have like a Babe Schneider-esque arc at some point this summer, right, where he like comes up like Davis Schneider did and times a hot streak with a point where the Blue Jays have some, you know, some like an injury or something that Orelvis is filling in for, and goes out and hits a gang of extra base hits and homers and doubles in the span of like 3 weeks, that would be massive.
Pitch. Is hit in the air towards right center field. This is crushed towards the wall, and it's gone. A three-run homer over the wall, giving Buffalo a 4-3 lead.
If, like you mentioned, an Alan Roden, like if he can take what are already really elite bat-to-ball skills and amazing barrel accuracy, barrel control, ability to make contact, and add in some power, and maybe take a few more chances and hunt some certain pitches, take some bigger swings, like just leave the yard a bit more, and then turn up and do that for the Blue Jays at the big league level, that would be huge. Because like just like we said with the pitching depth, like the Blue Jays are going to lean into their position player depth at some point as well. Someone's going to get hurt, and someone's going to underperform, and something's not going to work out. Like it's the biggest question of every baseball season. It's the unknown. It's what is going to happen that the Blue Jays are not prepared for, that Arden and Ben aren't anticipating, that none of us are talking about during spring, that we're all going to look back on 6 months from now and be like, huh, like that thing happened that none of us expected or talked about or thought was going to be the case. This happens in every baseball season. There is something that we aren't currently thinking of, that no one's scenario planning for, that will arise, and it'll be up to, you know, the Blue Jays' depth, both on the position player side and the pitching side, will be the true test of whether they are able to overcome whatever that unknown is.
Right, and the more support you get internally, the more it simplifies things as you're trying to backfill later in the season. So, for example, if an Ernie Clement does step up, and maybe he's able to really produce offensively, and he's kind of your fourth outfielder all of a sudden because he's hitting so well, and you just toss him in left field, and great, that's your go-to when Kevin Kiermaier needs a day off or when Dalton Varsho does. Well, that's a huge development because it helps you win in the moment, but also then that means that once you get to July, you're not sitting there at the trade deadline looking at your roster and saying, okay, Davis Schneider didn't really hit, Espinal's gone, Clement didn't really hit, Orelvis Martinez isn't quite ready. Okay, now we have to go out. We have to add a right-handed bat, because that is a question on this team right now, is who is that complementary right-handed bat on this ball club? So that means if you have that internally, then you can go out and really focus on getting that big reliever. And that's where your resources can go from a scouting standpoint, from a prospect standpoint. We know they're going to need a big reliever at the deadline. Boom, you can go out and do that. So not to get like 4 months ahead of things, but I do think that the more solutions you have internally, it does simplify things down the road.
Sure, and if a Connor Cook or a Mason Fluarty or a TJ Brock wants to emerge from this from internally as like a potential leverage reliever this year, that would be helpful as well. Like this will all play into the melange of you know, what makes the Blue Jays successful or not this year. But you know, for all the like majoring in the minors that we do on this podcast and throughout the year, ultimately like the primary driver of this is going to be the three dudes at the top of the batting order: George Springer, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., and Bo Bichette. probably in that order, by the way, to start the year, FYI. But those three, those are the guys who are going to make the most plate appearances if healthy. They're going to have the most impact on this offense. I really think that, you know, as those three go, the Blue Jays offense will go. And in 2023, two of those three players underperformed their projections, reasonable expectations of them, what they've done in the past, their obvious potential. And that's probably why the Blue Jays offense was a little bit underwhelming last year and really didn't live up to what you might have expected it to based on all the batted ball data and the hard hit rate and all of these things. So if Springer, Guerrero, Bo Bichette can come through with consistent results over the course of the season, all that other little stuff will, you know, be, it'll all take care of itself if you have those primary drivers in your offense.
Yeah, and Springer and Vladdy, a couple guys who, you know, have had ups and downs in their performance in recent years. And, you know, that's where, if you look at the roundtable that went up at sportsnet.ca on Tuesday, that's going up on Wednesday, you will see a lot of responses circling around Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and George Springer. And I think understandably so. These guys are just, it's huge what they can offer at their best, but they haven't always been at their best. And Springer, you know, this is a big chance for him to sort of make good on the biggest contract in franchise history. So we'll see what happens there. But, you know, when I look at this team collectively, it's funny because I was going through my own predictions for the roundtables that we do, the playoff predictions for the 2024 season. And initially, I had the Blue Jays out. I had them on the outside looking in. And then I looked at them and I looked at Gausman coming back. And the Texas Rangers were that bubble team for me. And I ended up bumping the Texas Rangers. And I have the Blue Jays making the playoffs. So, of course, there are so many scenarios where it doesn't go this way. And I can easily see the Blue Jays missing the playoffs. That would not surprise me at all. They have problems without clear solutions. So we'll see how it all unfolds. And I don't see the Blue Jays winning this division, but I ultimately do have them as a playoff team for this coming season.
Well, it's a good thing the year's about to start before you change your mind again.
Well, look, I mean, the more information we get, the more likely I am to change my mind. I think that's a rational response to new information.
100%.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. 162 games ahead, many more podcast episodes of ATL, somewhere between, you know, 0 and 162. We'll see exactly where that number lands. But we will be with you, of course, all season here on the podcast. Thank you so much for listening to us this week. And stay tuned for what's ahead. Thank you as well to our producers, Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. For Arden Swelling, I'm Ben Nicholson-Smith. Thanks so much for listening to ATL.